Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Seeing is not always believing, not these days at least. Pictures can be photoshopped, performances can be lip-synced, and the exotic destinations we visit can be about as real as packaged tours and local dancers paid to smile. We have olive gardens that are not gardens, and whole towns that are themed to please. So what is authentic today, and why do we long for more of it in our world and ourselves? This hour, On Point essayist Richard Todd on the search for the authentic. You can join the conversation. Where do you find real authenticity these days? Where do you find its opposite? And do you long for the unfeigned in relationships, in things, in life? Joining me now from Amherst, Massachusetts, is Richard Todd, longtime literary editor for The Atlantic Monthly and Houghton Mifflin, and a lecturer at Goucher College. He's author of the new book, The Thing Itself, on the search for authenticity. Richard Todd, great to have you with us. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
You clearly have a big itch you're scratching at length and with a wonderful effect in this book. What is it that's been bothering you in these essays, this kind of underlying theme for all these years? What's got your goat?
Well, things do tend to add up, don't they?
Yes.
These little oddities in the world, some of which I'm rather fond of, actually. I mentioned earlier my favorite reservations clerk, Julie, you know, at Amtrak. I kind of like her. But we do seem, as I say, at a moment here, to see the world through a scrim. And I found one day that I was getting a bit obsessed with this. I found it oddly when I was set about restoring an old house, and I found myself getting almost unhealthily obsessed with getting it absolutely right, with bringing it back, with doing really what was impossible, bringing it back 200 years to what it had once been.
And in that unhealthy, in that it wasn't a house of this age, it wasn't a house that was authentic, you were making your own little Disney World?
It was, no, it was a house that was, it was tantalizingly authentic. It had not much had been done to it over the years, but I became truly obsessed with getting things right, and I realized it was unhealthy. I think it was a perfectly worthy thing to do. It was unhealthy only in the sense that it made me think that I was really after something else. I was probably trying to solve a problem that could not be solved with old rippled window panes, that I was looking at some sort of absence in myself.
Maybe an absence in yourself or in the world around all of us of authenticity. I wish you'd... You talk about that scrim or a kind of a curtain between us and authenticity. I wish you'd fill out that picture. What's on the scrim? What's this kind of gauze of inauthentic that you fear we're all seeing the world through these days?
Well, of course, we do, as you did a brisk and quite wonderful inventory of some of those things at the start. We are used to doubting everything, I think, particularly what we see on television, and ought to be skeptical of what's around us. And we are listen to the people who would lead us and about their claims for their authenticity, sometimes rather explicit claims. And we grow skeptical of them, too. But I find that really this contemplation, the search, turns one inward. I try not to do although it's kind of unavoidable, I try not to do an exhaustive inventory of fraud in our world. I do sort of go into the belly of the beast on a couple of occasions, however, and for example, to Disney World and then to Las Vegas, to which I have radically different responses, actually. The one rather appalled me. The other was strangely exhilarating, Las Vegas. And I think I understood why. It was such a grotesque version of the world that we live in every day that it was almost a kind of holiday. It just let us relax and enjoy the absolute phoniness of the world.
But I want to get a sense here of how you see it. You don't see this as reservations of inauthenticity confined by the boundaries of Disney World, or for that matter, of the Strip in Las Vegas. I mean, you start right out at the beginning saying that this book, and it's a collection of wonderful essays, began with a simple feeling, the sense that my life and much of the life around me was not real, in quotation marks. So whatever is bugging you as feeling inauthentic is right off the reservations. It's all around you, and you may not want to give an inventory of all that, but give us some sense of the dimensions of what's feeling oppressively unreal or inauthentic to you. That's beyond the explicit theme park world that Americans so love.
Well, I think the place where I feel it most acutely is, in fact, in the landscape. We have such a polyglot landscape, and there the influence of Mr. Disney has crossed well outside the boundaries of his park and gone everywhere, and it infects our architecture, and we seem not to have a sense of the coherent landscape anymore. A coherent landscape seems to me to be a deeply comforting thing, and we've lost it.
And the incoherence, what? It comes from restaurants made to look like pirate shanties and
right, yes,
olive gardens that, as we said, are not gardens. Themed suburbs that have this or that look that were built yesterday?
Exactly, yeah. And people who... I'd go on at some length about my own desperate affection for the country, a place that increasingly becomes imaginary.
The country as in countryside, the rural
as in countryside,
life.
Right? Yeah, not as in nation, but the country as in country life, and so next to this lovely old ancient house in New England pops up somebody's concept of what is stylish, and it turns out to be an English Tudor dwelling or maybe some kind of split level. And these things, even though I must say, I mean, I chastise myself for this. I know that one should accommodate these things, but they start to get to me. You know, I want the world to be a place of context, and increasingly I think it's a world that is decontextualized. You never know what's going to be around the next corner.
There is a scrim, writes Richard Todd, between me and the world, that something more substantial, more essential lies behind or below or beyond the apparitions before us. We're at 800-423-TALK. Let's begin to hear from our listeners living in that maybe too unreal world sometimes. From Montreal, Canada, Jeff is calling. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for this great topic and your guest's insight. I just want to make two points about this fake reality that we've created. I think it's the downside of globalization. I live overseas. I spent quite a bit of time in Latin America. In Mexico, for instance, there was the Casino de la Selva, which was where Malcolm Lowry wrote part of his book, Under the Volcano.
Mm-hmm.
That was destroyed by a company called Costco, and they just put up a big kind of box store, and they recreated the murals, fake murals, of the murals that were destroyed by the company's bulldozers. And I think that's a very glaring example of the fakeness that we try to recreate after sort of destroying the originality of what was there.
And yet, Jeff, we thought that globalization was going to lead to some kind of genuine sharing, not necessarily to everybody being ersatz something else.
Precisely. And I spent a lot of time in Prague, which has become a kind of Disneyland, where you see little fast food outlets and charming little boutiques for tourists. But the actual neighborhoods have been completely transformed. The facades are there, but you have hotels and commercial malls, which kind of infest the historical city center. So it's become very fake, like a Disneyland.
Jeff, thanks for calling. Richard Todd, we just have a minute before a break here, but... Jeff looks at globalization itself and says it's kind of pushing a kind of inauthenticity. Now, why should that be? You don't like it's a small world after all in Disney World. Why should globalization make things less authentic, or do you agree it does?
I do. I think he has a great point, and not just its actual manifestations in a trashed village, but our awareness of our interconnectedness. As it does have a downside, I think, so that everything seems tinged with the knowledge that we are, you know, as I say, around the next corner, we may run into who knows what. And when we're in a rather beautiful landscape, rather nicely preserved, it begins to seem somewhat artificial to us because of its very perfection.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the search for authenticity in a modern world that can seem fake, fabricated, virtual in almost every direction these days. My guest is longtime literary editor and essayist Richard Todd. His new book is The Thing Itself, On the Search for Authenticity. Richard Todd joins me from Amherst, Massachusetts. You've turned to the philosophers and literary figures here to try and get a bead on authenticity and its importance and its sort of origins and expression. I wish you'd take us on a little tour of who taught you what when you tried to get some philosophical backing for your search for authenticity, Richard.
Well, the landmark book on this subject is Lionel Trilling's book, Sincerity and Authenticity, written nearly 40 years ago now. It's essentially a literary tour of the concept, and quite interesting in that authenticity is a word that seems to have been invented almost to replace sincerity. Sincerity once meant something very like what we now mean by authenticity, a quality of wholeness and integrity and so on. And it became cheapened over the years to mean, what we now mean generally is a left-handed compliment. You know, isn't he sincere? Or at least he's sincere. Authenticity became the intensifier, and it became in literature anyway. There was an air of the outsider about it. The authentic person was the person who was standing apart from society, who rejected social codes. And there's a quality of that still, I think, in what we mean by authenticity. What I found strangely was that and it's easy enough to talk about the authenticity of objects, but when you start thinking about the authenticity in people, you come up against rather conflicting ideas. On the one hand, we mean people who are solid, reliable, consistent, always the same, treat the delivery guy the same way they treat the chairman of the board, the way our politicians tend to present themselves. But then we also mean something utterly different, which is the person who is capable of instant self-invention, the person who lives in the moment, makes himself up, listens to that strange inner voice calling that makes him do something that is a radical break with the past. The person who we heard most recently, the most prominent person we heard use the word authentic was Riel Hunter, the companion of John Edwards. And it was easy to sort of laugh at this because, after all, there was John Edwards' lifetime effort at creating an authentic person now about to be destroyed.
By his companion in infidelity.
Exactly. And yet, you know, it is a little too easy to laugh that, you know, that she may well have meant it when she called him authentic. She meant that different quality, that something she saw in him that was willing to take risk and so on. So it's a very muddled and, to me, fascinating notion.
Of course, there was the notion that nothing was real. I mean, you remind us, the Beatles sang about it. Nothing is real, nothing to get hung up about.
Yeah.
Authenticity, schmauthenticity, you know, it's all a kind of veil of illusion.
I think there was during that time, especially during the late 60s, but it's continued on, we have had a little bit of a romance with unreality. We do deplore it. You know, we deplore all those things. And, you know, I write in here about the mall and so on and how I dislike the mall. And yet you feel, when you say these things, you feel just a little cranky, too, because, after all, others have complained about them.
But a whole lot of people shop in them and buy clothing in them that they wear on their bodies, which keeps them warm, which must be something authentic in that.
Right. Well, also, there is something in the mall that is, there's a sort of dirty little secret there, I think, which is that it is an antisocial place. And sometimes we rather want to be antisocial. I think when you drive by it and deplore it, you're really deploring something in yourself that despite all we say about a hunger for community and so on, is in fact counterbalanced sometimes by a sneaky desire to be detached from others. So a vexed notion.
Right. So the mall allowing that kind of anonymity that allows the detachment, we say it may be inauthentic, but it may be authentically something people really want, and you're careful to say that it's not. I mean, these things, even the things that are deplored, they are real. They stand there. We shop and converse in them, and there's some element of choice in that.
Well, exactly. Yes, and I think the world asks from us a sort of heroic effort at integrating all these things, you know, to somehow acknowledging, accepting, maybe deploring, but still recognizing that this is what we've come to.
This is what we've come to. Let's take a call. We've got a lot of people who want to join this conversation. In Somerville, Massachusetts, Dorothy is calling. Hi, Dorothy. You're on the air with Richard Todd.
Yes. I said to the other person, I think that authentic is the new phony and speaks to and the search for such a thing speaks to things that may be missing in the person. And authentic, the search for authenticity, is what makes us search out for Hillary Clinton, the duck hunter, as opposed to the very artificial Barack Obama with all of his education and that kind of thing. You know, you have to ask yourself, is something good for people? We may look back to the Olive Garden and remember it as a place that we had all these good times. I've never been to one.
Mm-hmm.
Talking to our peers or had a good time with our family there. I was saying there's a gourmet food shop opening in Davis Square at replacing a 7-Eleven. Now, I'm not a fan of 7-Eleven, but I'm starting to think of the 7-Eleven as being authentic. It's about Cantabrigians who have trouble connecting with the working class who will go to the North End and think that their waiter is ever so authentic. Or does it taste better, you know, or is it more authentic to put pine nuts or walnuts in the pesto? Well, put whatever tastes good in the pesto, you know.
Dorothy, you point up something very interesting. Richard Todd, I wonder, Dorothy's saying authentic is the new phony and painting it as a kind of what? Holier than thou or elitism or preciousness that can get wrapped up with authentic and does in a lot of kind of marketing, retail, you name it.
Well, I think she makes an excellent point. I certainly don't trust advertisers who trumpet the authenticity of their products, and especially do I not trust people who have the temerity to call themselves authentic. It's a word that I must say, the more I've written about it, the smaller space it occupies in my vocabulary of praise.
And yet you describe it and as something that people hunger for, that you have hungered for.
Indeed, yes. I think we do hunger for it. And I think what we're hungering for is that sense of wholeness. The closest I come to suggesting a feeling, a personal feeling of that, is one of those fleeting moments that when one can somehow contain oneself in all the with all the awfulness and all the contrariety of things that one has done, and yet somehow feel as if you add up to a human being.
It's not an easy laundry list to face up to sometimes. Maybe we're avoiding it at the mall. Let's get a call from Washington State, Coopville, and Mary. Hi, Mary. You're on the air.
Hey, hello.
Hi.
I've driven my camper across the country 9 times from the West Coast to the East Coast.
Yeah. Wow.
And I think that if you go on the interstate, everything looks like everything else. You could be in any city and not know where you are. But if you get off and go on the back roads, those old state roads are built on old wagon trails, and those wagon trails are built on Indian trading paths. And today, that system, they tend to follow the ridges and the high country, and it's where the good agricultural land is. And you get a strong sense of authentic place when you travel that way. You go through towns where there's screen-door restaurants instead of fast food places. And you can immerse yourself in, I think there is as much of our country that we remember with nostalgia left as there is gone. I was amazed at how much is still there.
Mary, I have to ask you on that. With 9 times across the country, you've got a certain credibility here. I mean, I know people who make those kind of trips, and they make it their business at some great effort to search out the screen door restaurants, to not just be at Shoney's or McDonald's or you name it. But do you have to go on a kind of safari to find that thing that feels like it predates the chains? Is it really so abundant? Is it really still dominant as you see it, Mary?
I think it is abundant. I each time I've gone, I've vectored north, west, or southeast and taken different roads and just taken the time to follow them. Looking at you can use DeLorme atlases, which will show you a larger detail. One beautiful one is old Highway 212, which used to be called the Yellowstone Trail that went from Boston all the way to Yellowstone and then to the West Coast. And you won't see anything except farms for 2 or 3 hours of driving at a time.
Richard Todd, mix it up with Mary here. She says she's crisscrossed the country a lot and sees a lot that's authentic out there. Maybe, Richard, you just need to get in your RV and go. What do you
say? She's got a very good point. I don't have an RV, but I...
You could get a themed one, maybe a kind of...
Right. However, I agree that it is a blessing whenever... one comes upon those things, and there are on those landscapes, and there are more of them than you would think if your mode of transportation is the airlines and the shuttle from the airport to the city. I had the experience just the other day, actually, in Baltimore, in the suburbs of Baltimore. I was staying in a very strange place, not strange, that is very typical, kind of absolute polyglot mix of suburban architecture. 15 minutes out, you're in some absolutely beautiful horse country. So I agree. Let's not despair utterly.
Let's go to Dan in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. Dan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom, and hi, Richard. It's great, stimulating conversation. I see a lot of connections with a recent guest you had on, Dick Meyer, and Why We Hate Us, his recent book. Mm. But just a couple observations from a trip I just led of graduate students down to Ecuador, and these are art educators. And while they didn't necessarily use the word authenticity, I was very curious about the objects that they were drawn to in markets, what they chose to barter for, what they chose to buy as gifts for other people, and in talking to them about it, you know, they talked about seeing the hand of the person that made it, buying it from the person or the family that created it, seeing the materials from the location they were in the products that they were buying. And then they talked about seeing Ecuadorian families traveling around together, seeing extended families in these markets. And so, you know, while I don't want to condemn globalization as a whole, I think there was a sense that, especially for the students who didn't travel internationally very much, that they had been kind of sandbagged in America, that they didn't realize that there was a choice to be made about authenticity versus American theme park land culture.
But Dan, does that leave you thinking that the contemporary commercial industrial is necessarily inauthentic? Is authentic a synonym for handmade?
No, I don't think so. But I think what I'm getting is that they didn't know that they had this range of choices to make. They kind of felt like the inauthentic that they see in the American culture that is surrounding them more and more has been a choice that's been made for them without their critical consent about it. And so, you know, I'm heartened by the folks that have called in so far, in that it seems like people are starting to take more of a critical stance towards, okay, why am I making a decision about what I'm consuming? Is it a good decision for me and how I feel? It seems like we haven't been that critical about it, and all of a sudden we're waking up and saying, oh, my gosh, what happened?
Richard Todd, how about it? Dan goes off to Ecuador with a group of graduate students. They see Ecuadorian families traveling together. Sounds quotidian. They see handmade goods, and they feel a kind of elation, maybe related to authenticity. Now, what do you make of that story?
Well, there are endless paradoxes in this situation, Arthur. In a way, we travel often to find what we expect and are disappointed sometimes when we don't. And I think at this point, many European travelers particularly come to this country with a positive relish for what we would call the inauthentic. I thought back the other day to a rather tragic experience I had. We had a young French girl visiting us as an exchange student. And at that point, I was in a phase of life in which I was trying to discover authenticity through being a sort of back to the lander, even though I had a 9-to-5 job. I was an amateur farmer. And this poor child came to America expecting shopping malls and swimming pools, and I was doing my best to take her out to feed the pigs, and she had no concept of where she was. You know,
take me to Vegas, mister. This is supposed to be America.
Exactly, right. So that did not end well.
And yet, you've got big swaths of the country now, or I should say growing ones, consumed with locally grown and the handcrafted out of the American environment, the slopping the pigs and eating that pork.
Yeah, well, I was tragically ahead of my time.
Didn't go so well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the search for authenticity in a world that can seem fake, fabricated, virtual in almost every direction. Opening ceremonies of the Olympics, lip-syncing and fake fireworks added to the TV video. My guest, Richard Todd, essayist and longtime literary editor, is author of the wonderful new collection of essays, The Thing Itself, on the search for authenticity, and we welcome you to join us. Richard, we've got some interesting comments from folks at our website, onpointradio.org. Here's one from Ben, who says, when you really look, isn't everything authentic? Even the cheesy theme restaurants, cable TV shows, plastic suburbs, aren't all of these things composed of real people having real joy and real sorrow and every other emotion? Just because they can't adequately describe something doesn't mean it isn't authentic. And then here from Eric in Brattleboro, Vermont, saying, what he sees going on here is an essential mental stance of diversion, a stance taken to an extreme level, and many people's reaction to the extreme. The longing for authenticity is a reaction to the unhealthy development of escapism in a culture. So which is it, or is it both? Can it be both?
Well, that the opening remark reminds me of a line of poetry that seems very simple, but I always found rather profound. James Merrill saying, "The entire world is real," and when you think of it, when that revelation comes upon you, I think it's an important one. I think that the really you can't flee the poor Olive Garden. The poor Olive Garden, I've never been in an Olive Garden either, but it's gotten rather beaten up here this morning. But you can't.
Hey, have a nice plate of pasta and don't worry about it. But right, yeah. Just an example of how everything is themed. Everything is something else.
But you somehow have to look it in the eye, don't you? I mean, if you just want to be able to achieve that kind of capacity of vision, which, much as you may deplore these things, nonetheless, you don't deny them. They're here. They're with us.
They are. And you began the book by saying that they're real. This is our life. But you also have passages here that very much resonate with Eric in Vermont, where you say we're kind of addicted to entertainment to the point that our world, and we haven't even come to the virtual world yet, but it's just infused with diversion, the word he uses, at the expense of something authentic.
Well, I think the most dangerous version of that really is the news as entertainment. And I am a culprit here, a victim. I spend a great deal of time watching the cable news networks, and at a certain point you realize that the information content, particularly since you've heard it through three loops, has ceased, and the entertainment content is rising. An early reviewer of this book said something that tickled me. She said that Todd seems to be in a constant, furious dialogue with the evening news.
Yes, and throwing your slippers at that screen.
Right, well, that's it. And I had not realized that I had revealed myself so fully, but I do have a kind of active and sometimes spoken dialogue with the evening news, and yet there I am, hooked.
Well, what about that electronic realm, though? You remind us that, TV's been around for a long time now and newsreels at the movie for decades and decades. But you say that somehow, it was simply that less of the world was seen secondhand, less was mediated, less was spun. Does that necessarily mean inauthentic?
Good point. But I do think that is true, that we had... I mean, we've lived under the influence of people telling us how to think for a long time, but the balance has shifted certainly toward secondhand experience, and I think that itself is problematic or trying. And it's not only the trivial; it's the important. The great undoubted benefit of our world, the one thing we can point to, is huge scientific advances. And yet, for 99% of us, those leave us feeling somehow less substantial. We don't understand them. I sometimes have called for jury duty. Mm. I've hoped that I wouldn't be on a trial that involved DNA evidence, because fundamentally, I mean, I'd vote to convict, I'm sure, if the evidence showed it, but I wouldn't really understand it, you know? Mm-hmm. I'm cut
You'd
off.
You'd have to believe, a leap of faith.
It was exactly, yes.
Let's go to Stanton, Virginia, and Richard. Richard, you're on the air with Richard Todd.
Hello, Tom. This is a most enjoyable program. I was working over in my cabinet shop, and I closed it and came home so I could get on the telephone.
Oh, good.
And I've spent most of my adult life studying this particular topic, both as a craftsman and as a scholar, and I'm just really pleased to see that Mr. Todd has done this book. And, you know, this goes clear back to the time of Longinus, the Greek rhetorician that wrote a book called On the Sublime, where he asks, if you want to have great discourse, go to the basic values inside yourself. And I think people are still doing that today. And there has been a book written, which has not been mentioned yet, by David Pye, P-Y-E, English architect and cabinet maker, who died, I think, 5-6 years ago. But he wrote a book called The Nature of Craftsmanship and Design, in which he talks about how we, at one end of a spectrum, create things with our hand or minimal tools, such as turning things on a lathe or throwing things on a potter's wheel or singing at an opera. To where we have workmanship of certitude, where we make computers. And most of our society, up until the start of the Industrial Revolution, was working down by that workmanship of certitude. And we kind of went from a wealth of poverty, where everybody made beautiful things, we didn't have lots of money. Mm-hmm. Now we've gone to the poverty of wealth, where we have wonderful high-tech things, but the things that we left behind, we're still searching for.
So do you think that wealth itself cuts us off from something authentic? Richard, when you're in your workshop with just you and the plane and the wood, is that more authentic than when you're at the poor beat-up Olive Garden with your family having a supper, maybe?
I think you come into a semantical problem, and in what, you know, so far you haven't defined what authentic is. And one of the problems of that definition is when people have become totally invisuate, namely they're not able to see in critical ways or to discuss or articulate what they see in terms of line, form, color, and all those other things that make up a visual vocabulary, then you're in trouble. And a lot of people who I've worked with the restoration of buildings and museums and fine furniture my whole life. And this is where, shall we say, the mud sticks against the wall, and that people come and they want to see and they want to know, and they haven't the background to do so. And that comes out of our failure to have design courses in our school systems.
Richard, hang on. Richard Todd, you've got certainly a worthy reader here. And while we're talking with Richard in Virginia, I've got another comment from a listener in Rhode Island saying, but be careful that you don't confuse authenticity with nostalgia. You know, when we're doing fine recreations or going to work with our hands in a period when handwork is a less substantial part of the economy. What do you say to our caller from Virginia, Richard?
Well, first of all, thanks to Richard for two book titles, new to me, and perhaps too late to save me, but nonetheless, I received them gratefully. As to things, I spend a certain amount of time in the thing itself talking about things, and I conclude that really the answer is not anti-materialism. The answer is better materialism, that we should be better materialists, and exactly along the lines that I think he was suggesting, that is, we appreciate the way things are made, have fewer of them perhaps, pay more for them perhaps, and value them more. As to nostalgia, oh boy, I don't think the caller could be any more right. There is and I know as someone who is prey to nostalgia. What is nostalgia, after all? I think, as I mentioned somewhere here, it is that longing for something that in fact never did exist. We romanticize the past terribly, but I am. I confess to having fallen prey to that false sentiment myself.
Cabinet maker Richard in Virginia, do you fear confusing what is past with what is more authentic? Is that a trap or is it a fact?
Not in the least, and I don't think one should be a Luddite. We live in the most amazing. I mean, just look out the window at the parking lot and look at the car or the computer that's in front of you or the microphone. They're incredible devices. But the thing that this nostalgia refers to, it goes back to Longinus, those inner values, deep fundamental things that drive us forward as human beings. This is, quote-unquote, the nostalgia that people were referring to. They're not quite able to articulate it. You go to any outdoor museum like Colonial Williamsburg, and you will see people gathered at the spinning the weaving, the brick making, the cabinet making, the pot turning, the blacksmith, where people are taking that the skill of within themselves and applying it with simple tools and creating, and therefore the expression of this is where I have found my greatness.
But do we have to spin yarn? Do we have to sit at the loom to be real? Do we have so many eons of that handwork in our heritage that we can't be authentic without it, or can we be authentic, you know, twittering?
I think the real critical thing to be authentic, and put that in quotes, in our society is every morning to wake up and say, where is the best person that I can be inside myself today? And by and large, that question is not asked in our industrial society.
We are very glad you came in from the wood shop, Richard. Thank you very much for calling us. Let me get another here from Wallingford, Connecticut. Susan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I took a vacation that I had put off for 15 years. I'm not very good at treating myself, and I'm touching with the concept of authentic place, hand goods, the expectation of authentic, and my story of going to the Grand Canyon, where I saw a sign that said, authentic non-Indian jewelry. And it just made me pause and think about what I expected from my vacation and what that meant to me.
What did that mean? I would think they would want to sell, they would want to market authentic Native American Indian jewelry at that particular place.
Well, this took me on a journey that I blogged about, where I found that the building that I saw this in was designed by architect Mary Coulter, the tower, the watchtower at the Grand Canyon, and her goal was to preserve and create some authentic Indian replication, and the souvenir shop itself was all about preserving the authentic Indian culture, yet outside of the current national park system that we have, are Indians selling truly authentic, handed down from generation to generation Indian jewelry, and there's less and less of it in our national parks. And when I tried to contact the company, the concession company, they said it is their intent to represent authentic Indian jewelry, but they are trying to
even if it's made in China, maybe.
But they really had, somebody had put up the sign, and I guess it was an unauthorized one, and they sent me their authorized sign. But the whole idea of authentic just kind of jumped out at me as what I was trying to do and capture in my vacation. I was going to the Southwest to find something real and different and special about that area. And every shop I went into, I found myself turning things over and finding that globalization, made in China, made in Taiwan, made in Ecuador, was in everything I was picking up.
Yeah.
Finding authentic was very difficult.
Susan, our time grows short, but thank you for that call. Richard, what have you come to believe it is that we yearn for when we're yearning for the authentic, whether it's in things or place or relationships or in ourselves? Can you say what is the object of that yearning?
Well, I think it does all come back to ourselves. Not that I discredit any of our desires in the greater world. I mean, I think we must face the fact that a certain amount of artifice is essential. In America particularly, we want things to appear to us organically, naturally, without planning, without any effort. But if we're going to have a world that is aesthetically comforting, as the craftsman said, we need to know things, and we need to do things that help the world, help us. But in the end, though, I think we are trying to integrate our lives and make them cohere and make sense. And a disparate, jangly, noisy world does make that a great deal harder But I think we have to be careful not to blame that world entirely.
Is it inevitable that we feel a lack of authenticity in the globalized world because globalization is a fact? In a world when others make things that we then use, because, of course, that's the way our economy works. I mean, are we doomed, or do we at some point adjust and find a new comfort, a new sense of authenticity in a relatively new global order?
Well, I think the thing that is most important to transform is the inner self, you know, the mind. We need new ways of thinking about these things. And that is what leads us out of the woods rather than anything we can do about globalization, which, after all, is not much. The world is on a course that it's on, and we have to think our way around it.
You quote J.F.T. Bugenthal saying, look for this central genuineness and awareness of being within oneself, and maybe that's where the authentic emerges, finally right inside. It's a wonderful collection of essays. I highly recommend it. It's called The Thing Itself, On the Search for Authenticity. Richard Todd in Amherst, Massachusetts, it's been a real pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.